Okay.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And it is another Thursday night. It is 7 o'clock in the evening in beautiful downtown Sherman Oaks,
it's
California.
Dark.
It is dark.
It's dark out there.
All we can see now are lights. Oh, what a shame.
It must be winter.
It must be, or getting close
getting
to it. Oh, 95 degrees outside there.
Yeah. Windy. Very windy.
Yeah. Santa's going, do I really have to do this? This is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in the studio with the one, the only vivacious, the charming, the sometimes irreverent, not often, Bobby Jean Bell, and of course, the chuckler from hell. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Jim. It's good to be back in the studio.
Oh, my God. Isn't it just your, this is just the best.
It is.
Is there anything better? Well, there's a couple things better.
Well.
But not many. Not many. Hi, Jim.
Not that we do together.
No, not that we do. No, that is true. Nothing biblical between us. And Bobby's husband, Jim, is sitting over here, as he usually is.
Yes.
Good evening, James. And you don't... Here, you want to say hi to the folks at home?
Hello there.
Okay.
He's real. He's here.
That's all you get. And next week... Bobby, you have your concert series.
We do. We
which
have Cary Grumbacher coming in from New Orleans. He's actually been performing throughout Washington State and some other areas, but home is New Orleans, and he will be with us for the Out West concert series. And that is a week from tonight. And if you want to know more information about it or you'd like to make a reservation, just give us a call at 661-347-9700, and we'll tell you all about the Out West concert series featuring Cary Grumbacher.
There you go.
And so since I will not be with you all next week, I do want to be sure to mention Target Freight Management tonight.
Yay! Do it.
We mentioned that they have a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. But have we mentioned that TFM Truckload gets your freight there every time on time? No muss, no fuss, at the rates you need for your transportation bottom line. Call today at 1-844-653-7789 and tell them you heard this ad on the Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra just for you. And while we're at it, if you are an LTL shipper, you are probably looking for the best rates at the lowest hassle possible. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web. Call today. You won't be sorry you did.
Oh, wow. And just to let you, our folks at home and across the nation, that of course we have millions of listeners, our the regular broadcast is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley. You can catch us at 805-795-3165 or info at blackdogpublishing.co. And Out West Boutique and Marketing in Newhall, California.
Right.
And that web address and phone number is?
www.scvoutwest.com.
And phone number?
661-347-9700. We'll get you us. Actually, right. Jim will answer the phone.
Actually, if you want to talk to Jim, that's how to get him. And if you want to call and talk to our guest tonight, the number here is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. And you really want to write this number down because I think there's going to be some of you going to want to call in and talk to her. She is absolutely fascinating. And our guest tonight is a young lady who is in Missouri. And she wrote a book called Called the Bank Notes. But let's give you a little music here to kind of set the mood.
Set the mood.
There you go.
Thank you.
They saw guns on the hillside, or so they'd agree. A band of vicious outlaws, but only one was seen. He had a cloth sack on his head, a shotgun in his hands. He didn't fire a single shot when making his demands. He just said, throw down the box, he ordered from the road. Throw down the box, it'll lighten up your load. I only want the money from the Wells Fargo line. You can go on your way, thank you for your time.
The law came out of hunt. That is a song called Throw Down the Box by our good friend John Bergstrom, who is actually a local man that is actually a great Western singer-songwriter. And he's been on the show before. A lot of fun. So if you see anything John Bergstrom, pick it up and listen. John's really, really good. In fact, he's a very good friend of the show and Bobby Jean and Jim.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a fun song because it's based on the true story of a California bank robber who went by the name of Black Bart.
Correct.
Never had a firearm, never held, you know, didn't really hold up people, held up Wells Fargo. And he got caught because of, and he would leave a little note, a little poem, a
exactly.
little charming poem. And he got caught eventually because a handkerchief was left behind that had his initial.
No, his
it had a watermark.
Laundry mark.
It had laundry mark
right.
on it. And he's very famous here in California for his. And as I read this book that we'll be talking with Carolyn about, this song just kind of just kept coming back to me.
Okay.
All right.
Well, our guest tonight is, she grew up on a farm in southern Missouri, and after graduating high school, she moved to Tucson, Arizona to attend the University of Arizona. She is now a public school English and social studies teacher who has lived in Arizona, New Mexico, and now Missouri once again. She is the mother of two sons, Rick and Kevin, both of whom are military veterans. That's awesome. Congratulations. You have my deepest sympathies and my utter congratulations. I am close to her, we don't know for sure yet whether it's still fiancé or husband, but Keith's twin daughters, Elise and Marissa, would you please welcome to the writer's block, Caroline Giamonco. Caroline, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let me get rid of John here. Okay, he's gone. Okay, big question of the evening, as we're sitting in the green room saying, Bobby Jean says, I think they got married. And I said, I don't know if they did. So, did you guys get married?
We are not married yet, but we have put in our application with the Department of Corrections to get married in March.
Okay.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, that's not too far off. What, 5 months?
5 months.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's exciting.
But, well, you know, we may have to come to Missouri to go to that. What do you think? You know,
that would be wonderful. You're welcome.
Oh, well, gee, thanks. I don't know how I do behind clanking bars and stuff, but, you know, I could always give it my best. The name of
you. It takes a certain act to get used to.
I'm absolutely certain of that. The name of your book is? That's your
cue. Banknotes, the true story of the Boonie Hat Bandit.
And he's called the Boonie Hat Bandit. Why?
That's what the media and the law enforcement dubbed him as because for three or four of the robberies, he wore a military-style boonie hat.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't wear it all the time, but enough times that they decided that's what they were going to call him, was the Boonie Hat Bandit.
So for 12 robberies, he was known as the Boonie Hat Bandit.
Yes.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit. Why don't you go ahead? We just sort of jumped right in. Why don't you go give us a little bit of background on the subject of your book on Keith and kind of how the story gets started and just, you know, fill our listeners in on just what are we talking about here?
Okay. I start the story off, first of all, by letting people know that I met Keith when I was teaching at the prison. He interviewed to be my inmate employee, my tutor for the classroom to help me teach the other students in class. And immediately we just hit it off. And it wasn't in a creepy, you know, hey, baby kind of thing. It was just, wow, this person is fascinating to talk to. And at first I didn't even know that he was the Boonie Hat Bandit. I only knew that he had robbed banks using notes in the St. Louis area.
Mm.
And a few weeks after we started working together, this young guy came up to the desk, a student, and he started harassing Keith, saying, come on, you know you are, just admit it. We all know you are. And Keith kept saying, no, I'm not. You need to go sit down. And the kid wouldn't stop. And finally, Keith said, listen, I'm way too high profile to lie about why I'm in here. You need to go sit down and ask your family to Google me. But right now, do your work. And so when the kid walked away, I was like, well, what was that about? And he rolled his eyes and said, oh, the kid thinks that I'm a chomo, a child molester. And which shocked me because I knew what he was in for. He had told me he dropped bangs. And I'm like, why does he think that? And he said, well, he fits the profile. And he said, look around, middle-aged white guy with no criminal behavior in the past. He said, you know, what? Who are they? And I was like, oh, my gosh, okay, you're right. And then I said, well, are you really high profile? And he said, well, I made the front page of the USA Today, and I was on Good Morning America. And all of a sudden, all the little files in my head clicked together. And I remembered all the news stories that I had watched because living in Missouri, it was local news. Even though I lived in the Ozarks and not St. Louis, it still made our local news whenever he would rob a bank. And it was making national news, too. And all of a sudden, I looked at him and I said, oh, my gosh, you're the Boonie Hat Bandit. And he said, yeah, I am.
Shucks.
So, that's how I found out.
So he robbed 12 banks basically in a year, 2007 to 2008, right?
Yes.
And yeah. I thought it was – I really enjoyed the book. I'm just going to say that right out front. I enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
I found him to be a very compelling character. The story behind his actions, what caused him to make this decision. And then you take us, of course, through the trial and then his life behind bars and you working as staff behind bars. Very, very interesting. It's a world I, of course, know nothing about.
Yeah, and not many people do, and that was one of the reasons why we thought it was important to tell the story. I think that there's a good chance that it's about the only book out there that's written about the maximum security prison environment, written from the perspective of both an inmate and a staff member.
Right. Now, he was apprehended after the 12th robbery. And he was told something very interesting that evening that, you know, if he had stopped at number 11, he probably wouldn't have been caught.
Yes. The FBI agent on the night that he was arrested told him that if he had stopped at number 11, they never would have known who he was, which was kind of interesting because, you know, the police will tell the media, oh, we have a suspect or we're following a blue car or whatever. And really it had nothing to do with anything attached to Keith. They had zero idea. And the FBI agent even told him that they thought that maybe he was coming in from out of state, from Chicago or someplace like that. And if he had stopped, it would still be unsolved.
So since he really, you know, he had no history of crime and all, this was his first sort of foray into this world. How did he kind of prepare to do these robberies? You cover it beautifully in the book. How did he prepare to do these robberies?
Well, it started with a joke. I don't want to give away the whole book, but it started with just kind of an offhand joke by his mother saying, well, after he was explaining to her some of his financial woes and concerns that he had as a single parent with the market crashing and the housing market going upside down, and he wasn't sure what to do. And his mom kind of laughed and said, well, just don't do something like rob a bank. And he laughed that night, but then he thought, huh. And so he started doing research into it. And he got online and he started doing internet searches, and his site that gave him the most information was the FBI website itself.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Go figure.
And then when he shares about that, I think they go to the web. The FBI makes some major changes on the site, as I recall.
Yeah, when the FBI agent asked him the night of his arrest, well, how did you learn how to do all this? And Keith said, you guys taught me. And the agent was like, what's that? And Keith explained to him about the website. And the guy said, I think we need to make some changes. And I think they did, too.
Yeah, well, yeah, and they did make changes.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
In a hurry, I believe.
I'm sure you've got a question there for her, Jim.
Oh, Carol, I have lots of questions.
I know. We both have, like, reams
it's
of paper
just like,
here.
You know, reading this book, it's actually a page burner. It truly is. And you get to know Keith really well.
Mm-hmm. He's very authentic. And
he's a really real guy. And
he is. And that was one of the things that we wanted to do was make sure and just be honest.
Right. Right. Well, it came out. Mm-hmm. It did come out. And you know, I got to looking at Missouri and the federal system in the southwestern region, and then the system in Missouri. And as you pointed out, they can give you double jeopardy. The feds can do one thing, and the state will turn right around and do something else. And nail you.
And not every state is that way.
No, hardly any state is that way. I don't know if it's because Missouri is backwards or they just don't really give a damn about the law.
I think that a lot of the problem comes along with, I think for one thing, in some parts of the country, and I'm from Missouri, there's a puritanical streak where people want to punish when somebody makes a mistake. Mm-hmm. And I also think that while in political terms these days, a lot of people support term limits, and Missouri has term limits, there's another side to that coin. Mm. People don't like politicians in office for a long time because they think they become too powerful or corrupt. But if they have no history, if they go in and the longest anybody can be in office is 12 years, then even the people who are in the latest terms of office that they can serve in this state, if it happened 15 years ago, they think that Moses wrote it on or carried it down from the mountain, written on stone tablets. Mm-hmm. They don't know that the law wasn't always that way. Mm-hmm. And as I talk about in the book, there are certain things about the laws that affect Keith and affect a lot of people in Missouri that happened back in the 90s. And there's nobody in office who is aware of how or when those changes happen. They just assume, well, that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's hard to get people to make a change if they think that somehow they're bucking the system instead of just going back and righting a wrong.
Yeah. Now, Keith, he copped a plea to the feds for, what, 5 robberies?
No, for all 12.
Oh, for all 12.
He pled guilty to all 12 of them.
And they were going to give him like 5 years, four
six
years?
Six and a half.
Six and a half years?
Something
years.
Like 6 years and 4 months.
Okay.
He was sentenced to 6 years and 4 months.
And then St. Louis decided that they were going to try him again for, what, 7 more or 7 total?
Well, what happened was he pled guilty in federal court to all 12.
Right.
He was sentenced to 6 years and 4 months. And once that happened, St. Charles County in Missouri, where 5 of the robberies took place, they said, okay, the feds have taken jurisdiction, we're good with it, and they referred everything over to the feds, and they were done. St. Louis County said, oh, no, and they put off and put off and put off their trial until Keith's guilty plea and conviction in federal court were finalized. And then they used his guilty plea in federal court for the exact same crime for a slam dunk prosecution in state court, and they sentenced him to 20 years.
So is it a total? He has to do 6. Well, but the 6 years now exonerates, and he's on state time now. Is that correct?
He's actually been on state time the entire time.
Okay.
The federal sentence ended up being concurrent with his.
Oh, it did. Okay.
State trial. So 2 years ago, September of 2014. His waiver was detainer was waived for the federal, so he would have already been home 2 years ago if it was just the federal.
Now, he was convicted what year?
He was arrested in 2008, and he was sentenced in 2010.
Oh, so, okay. Mm-hmm.
Two years.
Oh, yes.
Speedy trial.
Yes.
Yeah, just 2 years in jail. Yeah.
See, I don't profess to be an attorney. I just play one on TV.
Yeah. Well, and then you cover what is so interesting about the book. We get the two perspectives. So we're hearing Keith's story, which you record brilliantly, and then we hear your story. And so as the reader, we get the two views. And you really take it upon yourself to get very involved in justice reform and looking at something called the 85% law, which, of course, I was totally unfamiliar with. Tell us about I don't know that that's the right term, but you know what I'm talking about.
No, it has to do with 85% mandatory minimums for certain felonies, which means that if you're convicted, it's called the Truth in Sentencing Law, which is part of the Clinton crime bill from the 90s. And under that bill, if you're sentenced to, say, 20 years, you have to serve at least 85% of that, which means 17 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the issues that I was talking about, where term limits are a problem. When I started working on this a couple of years ago in Missouri, none of the legislators in the state that I talked to could tell me where 85% came from. And 85% in Missouri came from the 1990s. In 1994, the Clinton crime bill gave federal funding incentives to states who would increase their mandatory minimums to 85%, just like the feds had done. Mm-hmm. And they made the offer of federal funding. 13 states took them up on it. Missouri was one of them. Mm-hmm. And it worked out so well. They raised their mandatory minimum in 1994 from 40% to 85%. They started getting so much money in because of that they started building prisons. In the 1980s, we had two prisons. We had one men's facility and one women's facility, and we had 5,000 inmates in Missouri. Now we have 22 prisons in Missouri and over 33,000 inmates in our state.
That's like half your population, isn't it?
They can't get out on parole. And
right.
So even first offenders and, you know, this is what was, to me, so very interesting that you put a spotlight on things that most of us really, you know, we don't know anything about
right.
this.
Right.
It's in the shadows of society, and so many people don't want to talk about prison, and it makes them uncomfortable, or they've got this feeling, well, they did something wrong, so they need to be punished. Well, yeah, there's a difference, though, between being punished and overkill, and there's a difference between punishing somebody for a crime that they commit and all the taxpayers of the state being buried under debt trying to sustain this prison system.
Oh, absolutely.
Because what happened was, in 1994, we increased it to 85% for first degree, for what was called armed robbery and also attempted murder. Those were two of the crimes that fell under 85%. And it was going so well, and so much federal money was coming in that was being used to build new prisons, and it was almost a Field of Dreams scenario where if they build it, they'll fill it. And
well, it's always the case,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And so in 2004, they expanded the state of Missouri. The legislature expanded the statutes so that more people would be covered under those same categories, so they could get even more money coming in. So first-degree robbery is what they called armed robbery. So we didn't have armed robbery anymore, which by nature means you have to have a weapon. Now, first-degree robbery, which is what Keith was sentenced under, even though he didn't have a weapon, all it takes is for somebody to say, a witness to say, well, he could have had a weapon.
Yeah, a perceived sense. That,
exactly. And that's not hard for either a prosecutor or a police officer to get somebody to say, a witness, because they could say, well, did he have a weapon? No, he didn't. Are you sure? Well, no, I didn't see one.
But could he have had
a weapon?
Yeah.
All it takes is that. And they go, well, yeah, he could have. Boom, you've got a first degree offense. And now you're looking at 85%. Attempted murder became first degree assault, which instead of trying to kill somebody, you don't have to show that the intent was to kill anybody. It just says that you've inflicted serious bodily injury. And there's so much discrepancy between different jurisdictions, different courtrooms, different counties, that can be interpreted 100 different ways. Serious bodily injury, is that a broken jaw, or is that you're in a coma?
Right.
And so a whole bunch of people started getting scooped up in this umbrella under 85%. But then about 8 years ago, the federal funding stopped. So now the state of Missouri is paying for all these lengthy sentences without the federal money coming in.
Oops.
Yeah. There needs to be some reform.
There does. Every single taxpayer in Missouri should be saying, why are we doing this? Especially when the Clintons themselves have said that it's a failed policy.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. And keep saying.
So.
Now, I have going through the book, and then you started getting a little bit of hope towards the end of the book, where he's got an attorney, and she seems to be pretty good, and bam, she's gone. It's like she did a disappearing act.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets another attorney, and she seems to be pretty good, and bam, she's gone.
Because there were so many reasons to appeal.
Right.
From jurors falling asleep to,
the
judges falling asleep.
Right, judges. And so finally, I believe it was at the end, towards the end of the book, Carolyn, you mentioned that he finally got himself an attorney that was really worth the time.
He is. Kevin Schreiner out of Clayton, Missouri.
And
he's done an awesome job.
He's really done a good job for Keith. I don't know how far they've gotten on their appeals and stuff. But I know that now
it's in the federal system, and it's just awaiting a decision.
Well, does he have to appeal through the feds, or does he have to appeal through the state? It seems that's where the longest sentence came from.
He's already gone through the state process.
He has.
And the way it works is, it goes back, for example, his appeal went back to the same courtroom that his original state decision came from.
Sure.
So it's not likely that a judge is going to say, yep, I messed up on that one.
Yeah, not the same judge, especially.
Especially if you read the book, it's mm-hmm. very unlikely that judge would.
Right.
And
right,
so
right.
You have to turn through the entire state appeal process before you can go onto the federal level. And so that's where we're at.
Okay, so the big question is, how is it looking?
We don't know.
We don't know.
All we know is it's a good sign that it's not been denied.
Mm-hmm. As long as
it's almost a no news is good news
right.
situation, because and that's why it was so important to have a good quality lawyer do the appeal, because Keith has known people who've gotten to the federal level and they've done their appeal themselves mm-hmm. pro se. And within 3 to 5 months, they've gotten a rejection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are you?
So it's a good sign that it's been in the system for a year and a mm-hmm. half, and we haven't been told no yet.
Well, that's good. That's
are
good
you
thing.
Are you hopeful that that this book may be have a positive influence on changing people's hearts or minds?
I think one of the most important things. I didn't mean to interrupt,
but I
think one of the most important things is that people first and foremost start looking at the incarcerated as human beings and as people,
right?
And not see them just as monolithic monsters, because you guys read the story. You know Keith is not a monster.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, we got that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's a lot easier for people to say, lock them up and throw away the key and don't ever let them out, and who cares what happens to them if they're painted with this brush of being a monster or being a terrible person. And so I think it's really important to infuse humanity back into the equation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain crimes, I'm not an attorney, but I think there are certain crimes, and I think bank robbery without the use of a weapon, it's kind of like Woody Allen's movie, Take the Money and Run. I don't know if you mm-hmm. ever saw that movie, but it's wonderful, because he gives the teller a note, and she hands it back to him. She says, excuse me, is that gub or gun? He goes, no, that's gun. You know, but I mean, I digress. But there are certain crimes that I think that probably require, or not require, but deserve a second, third, maybe even a fourth look, especially when there's been virtually no threat. There's been no waving of a weapon. There's been no threatening of anybody being harmed or injured. And nobody was harmed and injured, other than maybe an ego and maybe, you know, somebody got embarrassed because their cage got robbed. But other than that, I don't, throwing people in jail, you know, we all watch Law and Order.
Well, yeah, and don't they come to trial really fast on all those shows?
I know, they do, like in an hour, they're yeah. tried, they're
exactly.
caught, tried, and convicted.
You know yeah. it's going to happen in an hour, and it does not work that way.
No. But, I mean, like in Keith's case, and I mean, I remember thinking this, and I still am. I mean, you know, I think you commit a crime, you do your time. That's the way I am. Not saying that it would do me justice to go to jail, because God knows I've done stuff that I got away with. But I think that when you're being double dealt in a system that's corrupt, primarily
exactly,
corrupt.
And the whole point of Keith's case is that he never tried to dodge responsibility.
Right.
He accepted responsibility.
Sure.
He pled guilty in federal court for all 12 of them. He manned up to it. The problem was when not just the state of Missouri, because St. Charles County didn't jump in on this. So a selective prosecutor, and it was the same prosecutor, his name's Bob McCullough, same prosecutor as Ferguson, who likes to have the cameras roll and whose family's in law enforcement, and I'm sure did not like the fact that Keith had made the St. Louis area police look like imbeciles for an entire year because they had no idea who he was.
Well, I'm sure he was pissed.
I think that he had some personal motivation to stick it to Keith, because the prosecutor from St. Charles County didn't choose to do that.
Yeah, yeah. But don't you think
and
he really would have stuck it to anybody?
It's not a problem with committing a crime and doing your time, because Keith accepted responsibility for what he did, and he was sentenced by the feds.
Right.
And he has completed that.
As a matter of fact, in your book, which was a great passage, and I have to say, it was after he had been caught. And he's sitting in the interrogation room, and the cop's sitting in there with him, and he goes, "I'm just going to save you a whole bunch of time. I did it."
Yeah.
And the cop,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
What did you just say? He says, "I did it. I did them all. That was all me." And he goes, "Wait a minute. I got to go get somebody."
Yeah.
Hey, Carolyn, how did you – I'm always interested in how a book is titled. Was the title with you all along, or did it come to you as you were writing? Tell us about that title selection.
We had started talking about writing the book. It started off between the two of us as a joke. People had been, from the very night that he was arrested, a police officer approached Keith asking about writing a book with him. And Keith was like, "I hadn't thought about that before, but buddy, it is not going to be with you." And so... That idea had stuck with him, but we hadn't ever talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was taking a college class, and he's a brilliant guy, but a terrible speller. And I would proofread his and my other tutor's papers for their business class. And I looked at him, and I said, I'm just saying that if you ever decide to write a book or a screenplay, you might want to have me proofread it before you
and
send it off.
Yeah.
And he laughed, and he said, "I will." So this idea of the story kind of came to us. Well, then as time went by and as more things happened in the course of us knowing each other, like we saw so many things going on in the prison, and we started to become more serious about making it a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before I had started writing the book. I looked at him one day and I said, "I know the title of the book." And he was all ears. And I said, "Banknotes," and he loved it. And that's just what we went with.
Because it kind of has multiple meanings if
right.
you think about it.
Right.
You know.
It does. Yeah, because banknotes is another word for currency, and he
yes.
used notes to rob banks.
Right, right. Now, I remember when Jeannie Loyacono, who's your agent, incidentally. Hi, Jeannie. I know you're listening.
We know
you
listen
to everyone.
Yeah,
we'll be listening.
We'll be listening. You.
We all love you, Jeannie. Give me more authors. When she first sent your information over, and we were looking at it, DeBookie and I, she goes, "Well, look, this is the true story of the Boone Hat Bandit." And I think that being in the United States and kind of following the Today Show and Good Morning America and this early show on CBS, we all pretty much had heard of the Boone Hat Bandit at that point, and that he had robbed all these banks with notes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That was the only part of the story that we ever got. Now, we nobody ever told anybody after the initial interviews did he actually interview with CBS or ABC, Keith?
Good Morning America.
Okay, so ABC. But after the initial interviews,
when he was close to the state trial.
Right. They never, ever, ever said anything after that.
Right.
I mean, there was no nobody ever knew what he got. Nobody knew what happened to him. What hole they shoved him into. And so the story, of course, went the way of a lot of different stories in the United States. As things go with the media, they just disappear. And here
well,
comes
and part
this
of,
book.
Part of that was because he chose not to talk. There were big name people who were contacting him who wanted to have interviews, and Keith is a very private person.
Right, right.
And he was burned. He was burned a little bit by a reporter in St. Louis that he had granted an interview to, one of the very few interviews he gave. And I explain this in the book, and they kind of stabbed him in the back and did a couple of reports, like one where it made it sound like it was an interview that she had with him. And all they did was right before the trial, they took a little clip where he was just trying to blow off some steam and laugh. I mean, we all try to find something to laugh about after a while when stress gets to us. And he'd made a joke about naming a racehorse Robin DeBank when he was talking with one of his best friends, Roger. And they made him out to be some kind of lunatic because he said that. Mm-hmm. And they even had Bob McCullough, the prosecuting attorney, saying that he was delusional, Mr. Giamanco's delusional. And no, he wasn't. He was just cracking a joke under a lot of stress. And we've all done that. We've all said things off the cuff. He didn't really have serious plans of, oh, that's why I did this. I wanted to have a racehorse named Robin DeBank. That wasn't it. He was just joking with Roger.
Actually, it's a good joke.
And I thought it was funny. And so he really had a bad taste in his mouth about mm-hmm. talking to reporters after that, because the whole concept of interviewing him was twisted mm-hmm. in that case. Mm-hmm. And so he's a very private person, obviously, or he wouldn't have been able to go a year robbing 12 banks without telling anybody. Nobody knew. And so we have a really good, close connection, uh-huh. and we feel safe talking to each other about stuff. And he knew that I would actually make sure that his story was told.
Well, you did, and you did an outstanding job.
And it's your first book.
And it's your first book.
It is.
Yeah.
And who edited your story? I know you guys didn't edit each other.
Oh, no, I edited the whole thing.
Oh, did
and
you?
then I had a couple of friends who read the manuscript over for me and gave me suggestions. Mm-hmm. And some of those duh things that you know, but when it's your own writing, you don't see that you're
right.
doing that, like right. putting that in 3,000 times in a manuscript.
Mine is
and. So I had that, and then Jeannie went through the book and did some editing and then sent it off for the publishers to shop out. And, I mean, it does help that I'm an English teacher of 24 years, so I have experience with proofreading.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You both make it clear in each of your stories that you have a faith in God, and
yes.
and it seems to play a very important role in the story and in your relationship. Do you want to talk a moment about that?
As we say in the very beginning of the book, Keith has always believed in God. I've always believed in God, but what got Keith into this problem was that he's always believed in God, but for a while there, he forgot to have faith. And he thought that he needed to fix all the problems that were going wrong in his life instead of having faith in God. And that's what got him off on the wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since the day he was arrested, he has felt very strongly that faith is extremely important. And telling the truth is extremely important. And his faith isn't one. I know that I've had some people go, oh, well, you know, I don't trust those people who convert to being Christians in prison because, you know, they just want to try to make themselves feel better. Keith's always been a Christian. Mm-hmm. He was the little boy who would walk himself to church because his family wasn't going. So he's always believed in God. He just has a very amazing faith. And his faith has actually strengthened mine, too, because when you have another heart and soul that you can talk to and that inspires you, it just makes everything in your life better. And so we both feel like, you know, we help the other one stay on track with our faith and keep our chins up even when the world's looking a little bit dark.
Well, and you found each other in this, you know, dire circumstance. You know, you would wonder if your paths would have crossed. One would hope that they would have somehow crossed somehow, being both from Missouri, that you would have found each other somehow. But to me, that's another part of the story you don't know.
Plan.
That's right. That's right.
No, you never know. I mean,
and we also feel that as awful as our situation is, and as much as we really wish we had just met a normal way, we really wish we'd met at a Cardinals game or something.
Yeah, well.
At the same time,
close.
And Keith and I have both come out and said this, but Keith has been very adamant about this, that maybe we were supposed to meet the way we were because we would be able to have a voice and we would be able to start explaining to people what needed to be changed in the system.
That's the power of the written word and passion, which is, you know, what,
yes,
how you're using this book. And you're working on another book. You have another project in the works.
Yes, I do. Actually, I have a couple. I'm nearing completion of a book called Guilty Hearts, which tells about prison relationships. So many times people think that if you're in a relationship with an inmate, you have to be the crazy cat lady. Like, what is wrong with you? And I get those looks and I get those questions when people are at book signings for me, and when they realize that I'm the woman he fell in love with while in prison, when they read the back of the book, they're like, oh my gosh. And they'll look at me to see if there's eye stalks coming out or something.
Okay, okay.
On me.
Now the question begs to be asked. How many cats,
yes,
do you have?
I don't have any. I have zero cats.
I had to do that, Caroline. I had to do that.
You did. Yeah. But no, I don't have any. And so Guilty Hearts tells the story of different families who are going through the situation. And some met after the person's already in prison. Some were living normal lives, and then the unthinkable happened, and their loved ones ended up in prison. And while, of course, I acknowledge that crime needs to be punished, that's not the issue. It's just that there's a toll that happens on the families, mm-hmm, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure,
so many people live in secret, and they don't ever want to talk about their situation. And it's very lonely and isolating. And I know, because for quite a while there, I lived in secret. I was afraid of the social backlash that I would have because of Keith being in prison.
Mm-hmm.
My brother has disowned me. He informed me when he found out that we don't associate with people who are in prison, nor do we associate with people who do. And I paused a second. I was on the phone with him, and I said, well, then it looks like our association's over.
That doesn't make any sense, though. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. But there are people who can be very vicious about being holier than thou.
Yeah, you're right there.
And yeah, and so it really made me very cautious about telling anybody that I was in a relationship. And then when banknotes came out, there was no hiding under a bushel basket anymore.
No.
I may as well be loud and proud, mm-hmm, because...
No,
everybody knows it's in print.
You're pretty much outed now.
Your radio show talking about it.
There you go.
Right. So,
right. You know, all 12 of our listeners are listening to you talk about it.
a baker's dozen, maybe there's 13. So.
But there's, and I would say with the new book too, that this is, you know, your voice is sort of in the wilderness and it needs to be heard. And these stories need to be heard. And the people that are struggling with exactly what you've been struggling with need to, you know, have the need to share the story. That's how enlightenment happens, we hope. So.
Exactly. And also, you know, everybody has heard the statistics that there's 2.4 million people incarcerated in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if each of us thinks about how many people are in our circle, whether it's our family, our coworkers, our church members, our neighbors, people that we, you know, deal with every day. If you think about it, with 2.4 million people in prison, there's a lot of circles out there that are impacted, mm-hmm, by an incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
2.4 million of them. And most of those people are quiet. They're afraid. They're afraid they're going to lose their job. They're afraid that the people at church will look at them funny or judge them. They, you know, they're afraid that they'll lose family members. So they, mm-hmm, just don't talk about being connected to somebody who's in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a lot more widespread and mainstream than what people think that it is, because there are a lot of people in one aspect or another that are affected by incarceration, whether it's the mother or the wife who just can't take it and breaks down sometimes and has to call into work because emotionally they just can't handle going into work. So the boss and the company's affected. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's the kids who are suffering because mom's having to work two jobs because there's only half an income now
right.
in the household. That kind of thing. There's a bigger impact to this, and the secrecy does absolutely nothing to help the situation. And the number one leading indicator as to whether or not an inmate will reoffend when they get out of prison mm-hmm. is whether or not they have a strong family and friend network when they get out, a positive family and friend network. Going back to the gang isn't going to help you. Mm-hmm. But
no.
If people can recognize that, you know what, you need to be supportive, and nobody's asking for a handout or anything like that, but just be kind and understanding. Don't tell somebody you're not going to be friends with them anymore because they're with an inmate, or you're disowning them from the family, or, you know, whatever it is. Don't turn a cold shoulder to them or act like there's something wrong with them mm-hmm. when they haven't broken any laws
sure.
themselves.
Sure. Okay, a little break from the subject, and we have to move along because we're going to be running out of time here.
Oh, no problem.
How are Keith's daughters, Elise and Marissa, doing?
They're doing really well.
Good.
Elise lives in St. Louis, and she has a very good job, and she's doing great things. And Marissa is doing fantastic. She's a manager at her work now, and she's just an incredible person who's doing a lot of really good things. So I'm really happy with the girls. They took two different paths in life mm-hmm. after Keith was arrested, but they're both really good people and they're doing great things.
And they're handling the stigma okay?
Well, they stood by their dad.
They have stood by their dad. And I mean, the stigma is hard, but they've got a lot of pluck. You know, from the age of 17, they've been having to deal with the fact that their dad is the Boonie Hat Bandit. And with both of them, they're both wonderful, loving, considerate, caring people. But I'd say woe to anybody who wanted to give them too much heck about their dad.
There you go. We're running out of time. You want to let people know, and incidentally, is Keith going to be able to hear this podcast?
No, he's not.
Oh, well,
such someday, a shame.
Someday, because you know you can go on the website and you can bring up the podcast and you can listen to it.
And it's on. It'll be on iTunes.
And
too.
iTunes we and Google Play.
We didn't ask her the question.
We did not. But no. We don't have time to ask her the question.
We now. Have to ask her the question.
Ask her the question.
Do you ever get writer's block? And if so, what do you do?
In 12 words or less.
I do get writer's block, and what I do is I just give it a rest. Some people feel like you have to write every single day. I feel like you lose the spontaneity if you do that. And so if I have writer's block for a while, I just let it sit. And the ideas just kind of percolate in my mind. And when inspiration hits, it might be 2 o'clock in the morning. That's when I get up and I put it down on paper.
There you go.
Otherwise, I'm afraid it'll lose the freshness.
That's a good answer.
We need to put these down on paper.
I know.
I think we'll task you with that. We'll task
okay,
Jim with
sure,
that.
Okay, sure.
Jim, you're not tasked with doing that. Okay, where can people find you? Email addresses, Facebook, you know, the normal
get the book.
They can go to Caroline Giamonco, author, is my Facebook page.
Okay.
BoonieHatBandit.com is my website.
It's okay. A great website.
It is.
Thank you. And my book is available at Amazon.com. BarnesandNoble.com, BooksAMillion.com. Some Barnes & Nobles have it in their stores. Others don't. If the one that you're at happens to not have it, you can request it, and they will order it for you. And I love to go around and do Barnes & Noble book signings. One of my favorite things on earth to do is do
well,
a book signing.
They closed ours, so.
We're open in Valencia.
Yeah, you have one in Valencia.
Yeah, we got one, yep.
You're the only one.
That sounds good.
Yeah, come out to California.
Hey, well, Caroline, thanks again for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation and really, 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 truly from the bottom of my heart, good luck with this because you guys deserve it.
Thank you very much. I'm glad that it affected you guys. I appreciate it.
How could it not?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a great story. And, you know, once you get the whole particulars, you know, your mind gets a little changed. And,
absolutely.
You know,
that's what the power of a good book should do.
That's what the power of the word should do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And truth, just being truthful.
There you go. That always helps. Again, thank you so much for coming on. And we thank Jeannie for shooting you over to us. And the bookie, of course,
okay.
as always, for getting you booked and getting all your stuff here. Thanks again for calling, and it's been a wonderful chat.
Okay, and once again, the book is Banknotes, The True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit.
Okay, and we'll put that out one more time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Caroline. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Caroline Giamanco in Banknotes, The True Story of the Boonie Hat Bandit, available on Amazon.
And I will Barnes have to read Guilty Hearts when that comes out.
Well, that's just add that to the stack.
That'll be a moving. That will definitely be a moving book. There's no doubt about it. She's a wonderful writer.
She gets
right
writer.
To the essence and the heart of things. So who do you have on next week?
I have with me next week a young lady who is a playwright. This is her. She's at UCR at the moment. Her name is Chelsea Hickman. She is actually just a recipient of the Mercy Meal Playwright and Award, and she is it's with one act play, and she'll be coming in and talking to us about playwrights and playwriting.
Wonderful.
and
that'll be great.
I believe we're gonna have a studio full too, so
that'll
you
be
know,
great.
One act play and bring in the entire cast.
Yeah, we really haven't had much in the way of playwrights or
no, we haven't. Actually, she's
so.
The first one.
Is she playwright. The first playwright?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Screenwriters we've had. I mean, you know,
we've had
they
yeah.
come and go.
Yeah. But that'll be great.
So other than that, then November, I haven't got the list with me, but I think we got a pretty good lineup in November.
We do.
We do. For the first 3 weeks, then, of course, the fourth week, we're dark because of Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be...
the end of the year is fast approaching. It's I can't believe there's only, you know, like seven more interviews for this year.
I know. And then we're done. And then we're into 2017.
Well, and I think we're already starting to get some
we have already booked
ideas
some
for 2017. Yes.
We have booked some people for 2017. So it's moving right along. Great show. We have a wonderful time doing the show. And tonight was no exception. Tonight was a wonderful, wonderful evening and a great conversation with a wonderful gal.
Mm-hmm.
So with that being said, we're going to close out our Thursday night. Thank you, Bobby Jean. Always a pleasure. Jim?
Wonderful to be here.
And I'm going to be taking off here, and we're going to be back next Thursday night with Chelsea Hickman. And Bobby Jean will be in Newhall with her concert
with
series.
Carrie Grombacher.
And we will miss you, but...
I'll see you on the 3rd.
There you go. Okay, have a good night. We'll see you next week, and we are out of here.